Good afternoon and welcome back. How's everybody doing? Having a good old time? Good. Glad to hear it. All right. The next part of my session, introduction to Windows Azure Compute and more thinking about it. I'm going to talk about potential snags. All right. You won't find many Microsoft evangelists talking about this, but like I say, Plotsky's second law. The amount of crap in the universe is conserved, right? Got less crap over here, must have more crap over there. Platt's first law, by the way, is entitled Exponential Estimation Explosion. It states that every software project takes three times as long as your best estimate, even if you apply this law to it. So, all right, let's go see. And Mano and I had some discussions over this, and then we'll see what you guys think of that. Okay. Well, certainly. Now, when you bring this to your boss, you're going to say, hey, boss, you guys want to do cloud because you're a bunch of geeks, and that's okay, I understand. I'm a geek too, and
I want to do the cloud because I want to deliver.
You want to do? You're a geek, okay? Let's face it. Come on, man. You know.
Thank you.
I was watching at the bar last night. You were saying, "Hey, watch me download this." What do you call that? Right? For me, I mean, I taped down two of my kids' fingers so she learned how to count an octal. Okay, all right. I'm a geek. So, so we want to do these things, and we're going to go to our boss. And we're going to say, "Hey, boss. Hey, look, I want to do the cloud." And you're going to get these questions from your boss. And it's a really good idea to think about the answers, right? So the first thing your boss is going to say to you is, well, gosh, you know, the cloud isn't under our control. What happens if the cloud dies? We have some other guys out there, you know, running in the cloud. And how do we know who they are? And how do we know if they know what they're doing? And then, gosh, what happens if the cloud dies? I mean, I'm betting my career on this. I'm the CTO at FTD Florists. And if the cloud goes down the week before Valentine's Day, I am just hung out to dry. So what do you tell them to something like that? Well, the first thing I tell them is, you know, Microsoft has been in the data, even though Azure is new, Microsoft has been running data centers for a while now. And they probably know what they're doing pretty well, more than most people, I would say. The cloud is likely to have better availability than you are likely to be able to get on your own, all right, is my guess. At least I think so. But if you still can't sleep at nights, what you do then is you think about retaining in-house whatever amount of in-house capacity you need to stay alive and somehow muddle through and get your job done as best you can. And a classic example like that, again, going back to the utility model, I find this very, very useful when I start thinking about first principle architecture in the cloud. Examples like a hospital or a police station, which will get most of their power from the grid for normal operations, but will maintain a backup generator capacity, which they test every day at noon or thereabouts to make sure that it still works, so that that they can keep the stuff going if the grid were to die. And in general, they will not have enough backup capacity to run the entire hospital. You know, the gift shop and the Coke machine will probably have to be turned off. The patients may not be able to watch TV. There may not be very many elevators going up and down, but, you know, the ventilators will keep on working. And so, you know, if the cloud going down is your biggest worry, consider keeping out some amount of capacity that way.
You know, what's nice about the cloud
is... What is nice about the cloud?
It's geographical distributed, which means that let's say something happens to a data center, physically, a bomb.
Somebody flies a plane into it.
It happened. It did happen.
Hey, it was in Tom Clancy 3 years before that.
So let's say something really bad happens to a data center. You can still have another instance of your application on another data center somewhere else around the world. Now, as you can grow up and down, you can... have more instances in this backup data center, and then you're back in life.
It just popped into my head. Is there any particular configuration that you should choose when you're setting this thing up, like when you're choosing where your thing is going to be locating? If you chose any, would that allow you to survive such a thing better than choosing a specific one?
We'll get into that later on. But yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll hold that thought until we get to discussing the geographical a little more. But yes. Okay. So that's a good thought. All right. So what if the cloud dies? Well, you know, you've probably got better availability. You almost certainly have better failover You were I cannot imagine that you were taking a step backwards in terms of availability. So that's the first thing.
You know, I ask my boss when he comes to me and I ask my boss, okay, so you worried about the cloud. How are you? How confident are you in your data center? Mm-hmm. Are you in data center pro? Will you bet your career on your data center?
Well, that's another very good point. You know, boss, you already are betting your career on your data center. You know, is it a better bet to bet it on your data center or Microsoft data center? Is the calculation that the boss needs to do? You know, I ask when guys are running data centers. Oh, client of mine who I better not name, and ask the boss. Well, what goes on here? Oh, well, the administrator types in the password. Okay, what happens if your administrator goes crooked? Oh, geez. Gosh, really good question. Really good question. Really bad answer. So you know, that's you're probably unless you're one of the top Fortune 100 companies in the world. Pretty good bet that Microsoft's got a better data center than you've got. I'll bet you.
Yeah.
But yeah, the availability. Suppose some bad guy decides they don't like anything with the M word in it. That's so you know. If you're worried, hold back a safety increment in your own house. Okay. Good thought. Now there is and this is the second one. I always get this. What happens if there if you have some data? You know, the data is going to leave your enterprise and going to live in somebody else's building. There are certain amounts of data that the company just will not allow out of their enterprise, period, stop, end of conversation. When I talk to financial companies, rightly or wrongly, it is an article of faith. No, those bits do not leave our house, period, stop, end of conversation. And in fairness, I have to say that these guys do have very, very good security architects and engineers. They have to, or they'd have been out of business 20 years ago. And they say, look, we have ultra, ultra, ultra high security, and we pay a hell of a lot of money for it. We don't know if Microsoft has this ultra, ultra, ultra high level, and or anybody else could possibly have this ultra, ultra high level, and therefore these bits do not leave our premises, period, stop, end of conversation. An example of this, Vanguard, the mutual fund company. I mean, there's no way are they going to let their account information out of their walls. The U.S. Department of Defense, you know, the locations of the Trident nuclear submarines, if I were them, I would not let that out of my vault. Period, stop, end of conversation. So an external cloud, that is not something that they're ever, ever, ever going to do for that piece of data, and that's just that. You might just consider, as you were saying earlier, Manu, an internal cloud, just to better use your resources. I heard tell about Microsoft building a cloud appliance. You buy this thing, like a refrigerator, and you can buy it.
Well, if you have a big data center,
a big data center, yeah,
you can buy Azure as Azure,
yes,
and install it in your data center. But you have to be big.
You have to be big, and the other thing is, you know, the automatic updates where Microsoft comes in and updates your things. Again, you know, Vanguard or the U.S. DoD are not going to let that happen.
Another thing, you know, I'm asking. Uh-huh. Let's say your data is really ultra sensitive. That's okay. Mm-hmm. Does this mean that the whole app cannot be migrated to the cloud? Mm-hmm. Because app is not only data, it's compute as well. So you can have some of your data in-house, and you can take my compute instances and put them in the cloud.
Well,
and
the
you can transfer data, encrypted or so.
To me, that data, I mean, these guys, you've dealt with some of them.
Of course.
And no, that data doesn't leave our walls, period, stop, end of conversation. However, these outfits like Vanguard and financial outfits and the U.S. DoD, they have some information that is very, you know, the most sensitive information in the entire universe. At the same time, they have much, much larger stores of information that is nowhere near as sensitive. And these could be very, very good candidates for the cloud. Any sort of financial company has prospectuses, for example, has quarterly reports, for another example. Lots and lots of these things that by law are public. And they make them available to the public as required by law. And the cloud could be highly appropriate for that, especially if you consider financial companies in the U.S. anyway have a rather strong seasonal dependency around income tax time, kind of end of March, beginning of April. They have a rather large, you know, to make the retirement contributions before the income tax deadline. They have a rather large seasonal blip there, 2-to-1 or sometimes more, I've been told. So the cloud could be a really good solution to that part of the, not all their stuff, because not all their stuff can or ever should come out, but some of their stuff, a lot of their stuff could. Again, the U.S. Department of Defense, yes, they hide the Trident nuclear submarines, but their purchases of coffee and underwear and things like this are probably much, much larger than that, and the cloud is probably a good place for putting those. So, ultra-sensitive data, is there any kind of... Is there data that should not go into the cloud? You know, no matter how much Microsoft swears on a stack of Bibles that yes, it's safe, there's some data that should never go there. My sense is that set is relatively small, and fine, just don't do that. When you're looking for a pilot project, look for some data that is small and not sensitive. All right. So that's the ultra-sensitive data. Okay. One of my favorites, legal and regulatory. The cloud is kind of funny this way. Sometimes it lags. You see, the legal process, the modern computing scene and the modern internet, as I wrote, I can't remember how many books ago, you know, is the fastest changing field of human thought that ever has existed. And it changes very, very rapidly. And the law and regulation cannot keep up with it. And so it's rather, and the cloud, the law and the regulators don't have a good handle on any kind of computing, a lot of them, and really don't have a good handle on what does and does not happen in the cloud. But the cloud can help you or can hurt you in certain ways, certain legal and regulatory kinds of ways. There is some data. I was reading some rules of the Italian data protection legal society, and they say that this and this and this and this kind of data needs to be physically stored in only either in Italy or elsewhere in the European Union. They had different sets of review. If you kept in Italy, a certain set of regulations applied. If you wanted to keep it outside Italy, but still in the EU, there was a different set of regulations and so on. But it couldn't live anywhere outside the EU. That was just what they had. And so, as you saw, the data centers are located in Northern Europe and Western Europe. Yes, you can. The cloud lets you specify that, all right, this data can live in this place, which is the EU. And so sometimes there will be a law that will specify, yes, your data shall live in such and such a location, and if there's a cloud center in that location, good. That makes it easy for you. Another reason that you might want data, even in the absence of specific regulations or laws requiring it, where you might want to have data specified in a particular location, is to avoid uncertainties. If you ask your company's lawyers, they will tell you that the law is murky, that the law is in flux, that they're not quite sure. But one of the things that no lawyers ever like is uncertainty in anything. And uncertainty in jurisdiction. When you have data that lives in one country and the producer of the data is in a second country and the consumer of the data is in a third country, well, which laws apply to the usage of that data? And it's hard to figure it out. And so you may want to avoid, you may want to store data in certain locations to avoid any possible uncertainty. And a good example of that is Microsoft Health Vault, which is here at Microsoft, there is this thing called Health Vault. It is a personal health record. Think of it as a three-ring binder notebook for your health information. It lives on Microsoft servers like your Hotmail lives on Microsoft servers. And you can put your health data in it. If you've got instrumentation like blood pressure or diabetic meter, it can get uploaded straight to it. Your doctor with permission is allowed to read it. Your doctor with permission is allowed to upload data to it, et cetera. It's a rather interesting kind of thing. Healthvault.com. I do some work with them on occasion. Teach their stuff now and again. They recently expanded to Canada and to allow Canadian citizens to take advantage of this. And the way that they did that was by going to a Canadian IT shop called TELUS, if memory serves, and TELUS hosts the Canadian Health Vault data for Canadian system for Canadian citizens, and they host it in Canada. And one of the main reasons that they had for this idea, not sure if it was decisive or not, but certainly one of the discussions that they had was that with the producer of the data being Canadian and the consumer of the data being Canadian and the data being stored in Canada, now there is no argument that any law other than Canadian could possibly apply. If the data lived in the U.S., well, was it U.S. law or is it Canadian law that applies? And by having the data in Canada, well, now there is no argument, there is no uncertainty, only Canadian law could possibly apply. And so, there isn't a... there isn't an Azure server right now in Canada, so they can't really do it. So if that is what you want, if Canadian location is what you need, well, gosh, Azure is not how you can get it just now. That's one of the legal and regulatory things that you need to think about when you start using this cloud technology. You know, what laws do and do not apply? What sort of jurisdiction does or does not apply? And is there a way to make this fit into your overall structure? Anyway, it can get a little bit tricky.
You know, even when we're speaking about data, the hybrid design, mm-hmm. which means data is on some location and compute is on another location. Mm-hmm. Some data can live in-house and compute instances can live somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And data can flow encrypted from one spot to another. Mm-hmm. When you think about your app, you don't think only about your data. It's a whole range of entities.
All right.
And you have to discuss this with your lawyers and regulators, of course.
Yes.
But it is a broader issue. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can store your data on a certain server, which is your server. Mm-hmm. And using Azure Connect, which is a new feature introduced in the latest PDC, with Azure Connect, you can have Azure instances directly connect to your data, to your on-premise data, where you control exactly where it is located, etc. Mm-hmm. And when this data is encrypted using your keys, the fact that the data flows to an Azure Compute instance, which is somewhere else, does not violate any law. So the hybrid model using Azure Connect can help in those issues. Yeah. But again, it is something to discuss with your lawyer.
It's tricky because, you know, suppose the compute instance was somewhere else. Is your data allowed to be computed upon in that location?
Well, again, don't ask discuss. Me. I don't know, but...
Another problem you run into is the regulators, you know, it changes so fast, the regulators don't quite know how to think about it. Got a colleague at Harvard, a guy named Jim Michelson. He is a professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School, and he works at Massachusetts General Hospital. I helped him out with a thing a year or so ago. He has a theory, which he has data to back up, that if he could get, you try to get women to come in for mammograms, to screen for breast cancer. You can get them to come in for the first mammogram, which is baseline. It's very hard to get them to come back for the second mammogram. When I said, yes, well, if they slammed your nether parts in those x-ray machines, you wouldn't come back either. But the point is that he has trouble getting people to return. And he says, well, look, dentists get 60% return rate. Veterinarians get 70% return rate. I've got 20% return rate in my mammogram clinic, darn it. How do I get the women to come back? Because that's what we need to do. If I got everybody to get all of their mammograms, I could lower the death rate from breast cancer in this country by 90%. So he claims, I haven't gone about debugging his data, but, you know, that's what he says. Now, he's got this server. This is what he does. He does research on what kinds of reminders are the most effective. Is a postcard more effective than a phone call? Is a phone call first and then a postcard second better than a postcard first and a phone call second? What should the phone call say, etc.? And then he's looking to scale this to, you know, he does the research and then he wants to scale it. He would love to do this in Azure. He would very much love to be out of the data center business. I mean, he's a pathologist. He's a researcher. He's not a good one, too, as far as I can tell. And he just really does it. And he would very much, very, very much like to get into Azure. He's got cash. He just, you know, is afraid that, he's not in the SQL administration business. He doesn't want to be in the SQL administration business. Problem is that he needs to comply with these regulations called HIPAA, whatever the hell it stands for, and it was regulations for data privacy in medical data privacy in the U.S. And he is not by law allowed to put his data anywhere that is not certified for HIPAA, and he can't get anybody in Azure to sign up and tell him, oh yes, this is cool for HIPAA. Now, for what I know about the HIPAA regs, I don't see anything that Azure does not do that is required by the law that Azure doesn't already do. What they need is for somebody who knows the HIPAA regs to look at it and say, oh, yeah, you're cool. That's okay. So that somebody in Azure could sign it. Yes, that's okay. We do HIPAA. And then he could use it. But, you know, because the regs are new, because Azure is new, you know, he's not sure whether it does or does not. He can't get anybody to certify that, yes, it does, no, it doesn't. And therefore, he can't really use it just because of the uncertainty over the regulatory compliance. And that's what I mean when I say, hey, this is too new, and the you know, there is a lot of uncertainty caused by the newness.
We are in the beginning of a new era.
We are, very much so.
And the regulations will change with
They absolutely will. There is a there's a guy here at Microsoft named Michael Stokes. He is, or the last time I talked to him, he was the regulatory and legal affairs liaison on the health vault team. And I went to his presentation in a health vault conference over summer before last. And he gave an absolutely spellbinding talk on the role of regulatory compliance in software development. I to this day, I am stunned that such a excellent, beautiful talk could come out of such an incredibly boring topic. And he likes to. He said that it's his job to get out ahead of the geeks, figure out what the rules say, and pave the path on which they will walk. And that if his programmers notice me, I failed in my job, is what he said. Search around for him, see if you can find that talk. It was on the Health Vault Connected conference in summer of 09, I think it was. Anyway, so if you're going to go this way, if you're going to do a lot of stuff in Azure, consider dedicating somebody who knows what the hell they're doing to getting out in front and taking care of the legal and the regulatory affairs so the geeks aren't bumping their heads on it. So by the time the geeks get there, the road has been paved that they need to go on. And hell of a talk, man. To this day, I still admire it.
No, as we know, the things will change.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe we can design our app to be easily migratable to the cloud when it will be okay in legal terms.
Oh, it's always tough. Everybody talks about future proofing, and if we knew what the future was, it'd be easy to do.
I mean, of course,
it sounds like it's.
It's like HD-ready televisions.
There you know. Go. Uh-huh. Or 3D-ready that they talk about today. Yes. All right. Yep. All right. And the final one, this I know this bugs you, and good. I'm going to bug the hell out of you. And then you bug the hell out of me back. The availability of cloud resources. Okay. You've got this thing in the cloud, and you say, okay, I've got 10 instances now, but I need to go up to 100 later. All right. How do you know that there will be 100 compute instances available to you when you want them? Especially in burst situations. And my analogy for that is getting a taxi in New York City when it rains. Okay, all of a sudden, unpredictable burst. It's raining, everybody wants a taxi. How the hell do I get to the airport? Right? And you got to start thinking, well, okay, how badly would it hurt your business if you wanted to scale up, which you couldn't? I've got 10 instances, I need 100. What happens if you couldn't get 100? Could you live with 90? How about 80? Et cetera. If I can't find a taxi, what do I do? Well, I could try hitchhiking. The subways don't really run to the airport in New York City, at least not well. I could go to my parents' house in New York City, but, you know, that's not something that most businesses can do. What remedies would be available from the cloud provider if you want to scale up at the time you want and to the degree that you want, but you can't? And that would be in the service level agreement. And you need to be very careful to the service level agreement and make sure that it specifies a level of service with which you can live. And continuing the electrical analogy here, there are all kinds of different service level agreements with electric utilities that electric utilities have with their customers that say just what the level of service is. I mean, the ordinary household level is kind of a best efforts kind of thing, and we'll do our best to get you power. And if we go down, well, you know, you're just out of luck, but we'll do your best to get it back up. With some larger customers, they will promise certain levels. You won't be out for more than X amount, and if you are out by more than X amount, we'll pay you some amount of money in return for it. there are levels of agreement that with their largest customers that say, okay, we'll give you this amount of power, but if our peak load goes up, we reserve the right to cut the voltage for you or cut the frequency for you or whatever it is, and in return for that, we'll give you a discount of such and such. There are all kinds, many, many, many different kinds of service level agreements that you have in the electric power biz, and I would expect to see many, many different kinds of service level agreements here in the computation biz. So if you go look on Amazon, they've got a rather interesting spot market for computational resources. Have you seen that one?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you can specify. You have a job of computing, and you bid. You tell, it's sort of like Google AdWords. You bid how much you were willing to pay to get that job of computing done. And then every so often, Amazon looks how many compute cycles they have free, and then takes the top however many jobs from their spot market, the top bidding jobs in their spot market and computes them. And, you know, if you want it done sooner, you bid more money. If you can wait longer, you bid less money. And Amazon gets to use up all their spare compute cycles because somebody's waiting to do something with them, you know, which is much better than letting them just go to waste. And guys that have big computing jobs can get them done at a discount if they come in infrequent times. It's so that's... It's that uncertainty the uncertainty of sudden scaling that I am still kind of uncomfortable with. The way that one controls that is through the service level agreement. Yes, sir.
What is the alternative? If you have your own data center, so now there's no service level agreement because you are the one who's providing the service. So if something goes down, nobody backs you up. Now, there is Microsoft who backs you up. Microsoft stands behind its service level agreement.
Well, but what I'm saying is if the service level agreement says that, yes, I promise you can pay for 10 but be able to scale to 100, if I had an SLA from Microsoft that said that, and if you don't, and if you want to go up to 100 and you can't, Microsoft will pay you X amount of money. That would be one kind of thing. If you or your lawyers could negotiate a service level agreement that said that, that's what I'm saying, that you need to think about what you need and what kind of scaling it is that you need, how much you're willing to pay to get that amount of scaling, and what would happen to you if it didn't, and can you get an SLA that specifies that?
Well, the alternative is that you don't have any SLA.
Well, the alternative is...
If you do your own data centers,
the alternative is
there's no SLA because you provide that SLA. As a CDO, I'm happy that there's someone behind me, someone who stands behind the SLA. And that's not a small company, that's Microsoft.
Well,
when Microsoft stands behind that SLA, I'm happy.
Happier, yeah. I mean, suppose you were FTD, the florist guys. And, it's probably time to move on from this one.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, think about how one controls for that. You know, just what your bursting, your resource scaling situation needs to be, what you're willing to pay for it, what kind of SLA you can get, how much that will cost you, et cetera, et cetera. That's it's not magic. It's something you got to think about. It's something you're thinking about to do. All right. The next thing I want to do is, okay, we've talked about what this is, what problem we're trying to solve. What I'm going to do now is I am going to go and I'm going to show you how you build your first Windows Azure application. And now to do this, am I sharing out now? Okay, content, yes, content, desktop, Dave, there we go. All right, there we go. You good? Okay. All right, here I have Visual Studio 2010. With the Azure downloads installed, and search around, they move. By the time you see this video, who knows where they're going to be. So I found it. I downloaded the Visual Studio Azure SDK and the Visual Studio Azure extensions. So I'm going to go and build here. I'm going to build the simplest one, and then later on today, Manu is going to take these and talk more about the development lifecycle and show you the different options that go here. I'm going to chop a path from this side of the jungle to that side of the jungle, but a very small, narrow path. And then in the next session, Manu's going to sort of start exploring some interesting clearings, bridging a river, that kind of thing. So, all right. File, new, project here. And when you install the Visual Studio tools, what you will get is you will get this cloud template here, a Windows Azure project, there, and we're going to call it Windows Azure Project 2 because I've got one of those, and I'll say okay. Stop me if I get too technical here, okay? So here now, there are these things called web roles, and again, you'll be seeing more of this in a little bit. You have to say, what is the computing thing that's going to be inside your Azure project? And the two main choices are a web role and a worker role. And a web role is a virtual machine that has IIS 7 installed, and a worker role is a virtual machine which does not. So for this one, I'm going to do a very simple, familiar ASP.NET application. And for that, a web role is the correct selection. So I'm going to pick one of these. I'm going to say, yes, put in one web role, please, like that. And I'll say, OK, there. And now this whole project gets generated. So now here, there, I've got these two projects here. This web role one, this is my ASP.NET web role. And you can see, if you're familiar with ASP projects, you can see this looks very familiar. There is a master, there's a master page there, like so. There's some content pages here, about.aspects, default.aspects. There's styles, there's scripts, there's the app data directory, the things that you're used to seeing, right? It'll look familiar, it'll feel familiar, it is familiar. And then down here, there's this webroll.cs. This is the entry point for Azure to reach in and start doing things to it. We'll see it a little bit later. So that's the web role that runs here. Here, this is the Windows Azure project. This is the project level piece. And it has in it, there's the roles folder. There it says, yes, web role 1 is a part of this Azure project here. There is the configuration file, service configuration.csfg, CFG. There's the service definition file, CSDEF. Again, we'll see these in more detail. Here, let me go look at default.aspects. That's the default page that'll be shown when this thing is comes out. There. All right. What I'm going to do now, this is pretty simple. Don't really care about that. I'm going to go to my toolbox, and I'm going to take a label, and I'm going to drag the label over here, there, and put my label here in on my page so you can see me actually doing something. There it is in design mode. There's a label, like so. Here's my default.aspects.cs, there. All right. And there's my system.web.ui.page. Pretty simple. I'll say here, when this page is loaded, this.label1.text equals, how about, datetime.now.toLongTimeString, like so. All right, and I can run that easy. And in fact, I can start it here on my IIS. It's going to run on my local Azure development simulator, basically. There it is, initializing the storage emulator. We'll see that a little bit more tomorrow. And up comes my page. And up comes my page. And look at that, 1:35, 27 p.m. That's what time it is here in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. All right? Thank you. Thank you very much. You're too kind. All right. Yeah. Okay, come on, heck with that. Come on, I know that's silly. Now what I want to do is, okay, that runs here. Now what I want to do is I want to go put it out on the cloud. I want to go take this. I mean, you can see this is a pretty seamless thing. This is just like, this is darn near just like any other ASP.NET app I've ever written. What I now want to do is I want to take it and deploy it out to the cloud and access it from the cloud. How the heck am I going to do that? Turns out to be fairly simple. Okay, you can go here, go to the Windows Azure Project 2 here. You can see that this is the parent and this web role 1 is one of the children. In this case, we only have one child, but this is the parent. So you go to the parent here and right-click and say publish. So I'm going to publish this, and it's going to say, hey, I want to deploy this to the web. And you can either give it the instructions here how to squirt out to the web direct from Visual Studio, or you can say create service package only. That's what I'm going to do. And Manu is going to show you this other option when he speaks later on in the afternoon like this, here, there. Create a service package only, like so. And it's going to show you. There's Windows Azure Project 2. bin debug publish, and there is a cfconfig file, and there is a cs package file. All right, so there's the configuration, there's the actual package, there it is, it's 3.6 megabytes, like so. Now it's packaged to get squirted up to Azure. All right? Okay, so now I got to get it squirted up to Azure. How am I going to do that? Well, it's pretty simple. I'm going to bring up, I am going to use, there's a portal here. There's actually a rather good new portal, which I've been...
You know, there was enjoying. A question here.
A question here, yes, sir.
Yeah, and the question was, you showed a simple ASP application.
I showed a simple ASP application, yes.
Yeah, what about MVC applications or other types of web applications?
What about MVC applications or other types of web applications? Okay, we're going to be going into more details of them later. The whole point here is I'm only showing the...
Yeah, the question was, is it possible to deploy an MVC application or other types of web application to the cloud? And the answer is
heck yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Quite easy. In fact, here, when you... the question is it possible to deploy MVC or other types of applications to the cloud? And the answer is yes. The way you would do that here, file new project, like this. There's the cloud. I go and make another one. And now, I guess I'm finished. Here, there, I can put an MVC2 web role in. So MVC I can put in just like I'm putting in this ASP.NET. Okay. WCF, if I want to put in a WCF role, if that's what you like.
And not only .NET applications, even the PHP application can
even
be deployed.
Even the PHP application. Yeah, I guess you could. I myself have not done that particular piece. I have to concentrate ruthlessly on my own specialty, which is .NET. But certainly the other ones have been done and can be done.
Yes.
All right. Good question. All right, well, I'm finished here with Visual Studio for now. And so what I'm going to... still can't figure out who's right for you. I'm a non-combatant these days. All right, so I want to go to the Azure portal, which is kind of nice. It's a website that Microsoft provides that allows you to take your stuff and put it in Azure and start it up and shut it down and stuff like this. And the place where you find it is in windows.azure.com, like that, just windows.azure.com. It's windows.azure.com. There it is. And there it is. And you can sign in with your, sign in with, in my case, my Hotmail ID. And now here, magically... Yeah, this is a new one. They built it with Silverlight. It's a whole lot nicer. This is the Azure portal. And if you wind up, I think the first time you look at this, they ask you, gosh, do you want the old one or the new one? Take the new one, okay? It's a whole lot better. I mean, this is the one that you see, right? So I'm going to show you here. This is the home page. And down here, this is the hosted services, storage accounts, and content delivery network here. So I'm going to click on this one here. Okay, now it's showing me that that here are my I can have subscriptions here. This tells you who I have. Make that a little bit bigger. That's better, I think. Subscriptions I've got here. This Rolling Thunder Azure subscription. That's the one I got myself with my credit card. Here's the Windows Azure Pass. That's that 30-day freebie that I told you about at the start of this talk. So you can see it really does work. You can only have here, there, it only gives you one hosted service at a time. Right? Okay, fine. I will, all right, I'll put this one in my, in this one. Okay. So what I want to do, I will pick one of my subscriptions here, this one here, and I will pick new hosted service here. You know, so I'll click on this new button here. So here, put it in this account, and it says, I guess I got to go to a smaller, there, enter a URL prefix for your service, and it's going to be this name at cloud.cloudapp.net. How about Plat Azure Demo, like that, right? Cloudapp.net, choose a region here. Here's where to put it, and you can pick... you can pick anywhere US, anywhere Europe, anywhere Asia. Can you pick just anywhere, anywhere? I'm not seeing that. I think you got to pick a continent. All right, I will pick anywhere in the U.S. Fine. There. And you can choose to deploy to a staging environment, which is where to start, or a production environment. Don't start there. The previous portal made it easy to sort of encourage you to put it into the production environment. This is a much better idea. Deploy to a staging environment. And here, check this box, start the app after a successful deployment. And the name of this deployment, which I'll say Plant Azure Demo Deployment, so you can see where the deployment name gets used as opposed to the service name or whatever. You got to give it the package location of the configuration file. It's pretty easily here. I'm going to browse locally. Go to my documents, Azure test, Windows Azure Project 2. That's where I did this one. There's the project. There's the bin. There's the debug. There's the publish. And if you look in there, there's my there's my CS package, like here, there. And now once the config file, what do you know? It's in the same location. What do they think of next? All right. And I'll say, okay. And before you know it, eventually, this thing will start. Why did it disappear? Enter a name for your service. Okay, that was probably above your demo service. Okay.
And what happens sometimes is that the name is not free.
Sometimes the name is not free. That's a good point.
So you get an error message when such such a thing happens.
Very good. Now, a warning has been encountered. Click to see more details to see the warning. Would you like to override and submit? Don't get me started on this terrible UI. It'll take the next 15 minutes. But here's what they're saying. It's actually not a bad thing to warn somebody about. The deployment has at least one role with only one instance. We recommend you deploy at least two instances per role to ensure high availability in case one of the instances becomes available. It also enables coverage of the Windows Azure Compute SLA, which guarantees 3.5 nines of uptime. And that's where you can look at the complete SLA. So this said, hey, look, if you pay for two instances of this, you'll get a whole lot better service, which is probably true. But this is just my development instance. I'm not going to bother right now.
It's just impossible to give such a high SLA when there's only one instance.
I understand it, because if it falls down, it's down.
Exactly.
So they got to have at least time to spin up a second one for the first one to stay alive while they're spinning up a second.
This is just a development. Just an example, so
just an example,
no worries about
that's
that.
It. Yes. So I'll say, okay, here, yes, go ahead, override and submit. And so now here it is. You can see here it is, Plant Azure Demo Service. There it is, it's deployment, it's uploading to the staging environment, and so on. Now, this can take finalizing the upload. Now, this can take a while. All right. Here it is, it generated a certificate. Here it is, creating the deployment. Here's one of those things that you don't have control over. Depending how busy the staging environment is, this will take X amount of time.
20 minutes or so.
20 minutes or so is not at all unusual. When I was taping a session with Bob Familiar for the academic evangelist thing, we started doing this, and we said, gosh, this is taking a long time. We went out to lunch, and we came back, and it was still uploading. So, an hour is not unheard of. Likewise, I've seen it done in 3 or 4 minutes. Not that often, but I have seen it. So, the number of deployment shots that you get per day is on the small side. And so it strikes me as you want to do a lot of your work on the local machine, to the extent that you can. So anyway, here it is spinning up. And sort of don't have a whole lot of time to look at it and sit here and kind of twiddle our thumbs expensively in an on and off pattern while we wait for this thing to deploy. So you know what I've done? You remember Julia Child, the French chef? She comes from Boston, where I do. I mean, we all like Julia Child a lot. When she was cooking a Thanksgiving turkey or something, she would stuff it. she would put it in the top oven and say, oh, yeah, I let this sit here for 4 or 5 hours. And she would open the bottom oven and take one out, and it would be all be finished, and it was great. So I've got a number of these instances here, the Platt Asia service that I deployed to Asia, the Platt Europe service that I deployed to, you guessed it, Europe, and that's the one that I see. Okay, the Platt Asia service here. And if you look at this one, you'll see there. If you look over here, here in the properties window over here on the right, when we're in the staging environment, it's not platasiaservicedeployments.cloudapp.net. That's the production URL. And right now there isn't. We're not in the production environment. So instead, over here, there's the DNS name. You see that's a GUID right there? This thing right here is a GUID. That is the actual URL at which you will find this deployment here. All right? So, so here's one that I put up earlier today when I was preparing for this. So I'm going to click on this, and here it comes. You can see there's that GUID at cloudapp.net. And look at that. It is 9:47.53 p.m. If you go look up the definition of datetime.now, you will find that datetime.now specifies that it is the local time at the computer. I've got this one hosted in Asia. If you go figure it out, this is 8 hours ahead of my local time. Remember when I did the local time demo, it was 1:37. This is 8 hours ahead of our local time. You know what that is? That's UTC, isn't it? Universal Coordinated Time. That is GMT. So even though this thing is hosted in Asia, getting local time returns to me GMT. And in fact, if I go here, here's the, okay, my current one is still spinning up, but here's another one. This is the U.S. service that I had deployed earlier. Okay, that one stopped. All right, I would need to start this one and see how long it takes to come up. Like so. Well, anyway. I think I will need to ask you to take my word for it, that if you host this thing in Europe, you will get GMT. If you host this thing in Asia, you will get GMT. If you host this thing in the U.S., you will get GMT. So when I ran this locally, I got my local time, but when I deployed it, I got GMT instead. So you can see that the production environment is at least a little bit different in some cases than the local environment. You will see that you will need to test each thing. If you were looking for your something to run on your local time, this probably isn't it. That's not a hard thing to work your way around or work with. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to have. It's probably a decent thing to have. But it's not exactly what it was, isn't what I was expecting the first time around. I gave it to my students as a homework assignment, and they came back and said, ha ha, Platsky, there was a little piece of cake. I said, yeah, I'll get you next time, turkeys. But it's, anyway. So that's how you bring this thing up. That's how you build this thing. That's how you deploy it. That's how you choose a location. That's how you put it there. That's how you test it. And so that's, you know, our walkthrough of the hello.cloud application. All right? If any questions come in there, Manu, or are we just blowing them right away?
They want you to lower your resolution, if that's okay.
They want me to lower my resolution. I see what they're saying. They want me to... Okay, we will look at lower resolution. Actually, you're up next.
Yeah, so I've already done that.
Okay. Okay, fine. I can do that. I will lower my res. That's fair. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, okay. Lower res. You got it. All right, so let's do a quick summation of the stuff that we've seen. Well, we started out by defining what the cloud is. We had some basic terms, you know, infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, software as a service. We looked at Microsoft's cloud infrastructure a little bit, their service level agreement, their various plans that you can buy right now. We talked about what scenarios are good and useful things for being hosted in the cloud, like the on-off pattern, the growing fast pattern, which doesn't get much press, but getting through that bottleneck, to me, arguably, is the biggest contribution to the cloud. We talked about the predictable and unpredictable bursting patterns. We talked about snags, the kinds of things that that you need to look out for when you're deploying to the cloud, when you're running in the cloud. We talked about the different ways to architect your application or your deployment for things that will work in the cloud. Then we looked at building a cloud instance, and we saw it's pretty damn simple. And deploying it to the cloud, which is likewise pretty darn simple.
There was a question, though, about spinning a new instance. Is it as slow as creating a new deployment? And the answer is no. Creating a new instance is much faster, and we'll demonstrate that later on.
Creating a new instance is a yes. We will be demonstrating that after. Very good. And we see that it takes a certain macroscopic amount of time here. And I think that is the end of the first portion of our talk.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to go take another 10-minute break. And we will come back here, and when that happens, Mono will drive, and I will heckle.
Okay.
All right.